The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the iSpeak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit iSpeakMedia.org. This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. That's 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are. Falling squares on TV
screen, still falling on. I'm Julie Smith, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
This is your first time here. Thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. So we made it November 3rd, 2020. This is the Election Day episode of the podcast. Man, it has been a long year. And I don't know about you, but for me, it's been a long 4 years. I've had a lot of feelings leading up to this election. It just feels really, really heavy. I'm concerned about this country. I'm concerned about what'll happen if Donald Trump is reelected and how bad it might get. And being a person who has always sort of followed the media and politics and has studied the Constitution a little bit. You know, what worries me about it is that I've watched him run roughshod over our Constitution over the last 4 years. He has really just shattered the norms of presidential behavior and just really defied checks and balances. And it's just not American. So anyway, whether you agree with me or not, I feel like one of the most concerning things that's happening in our culture is our relationship with the truth and our relationship with the media. This message that we get about how mainstream media is illegitimate and the press is the enemy of the people and fake news this and fake news that, it just is really, really troubling to me as someone who's studied journalism, who's done some reporting for a couple daily newspapers, and as someone who knows what legitimate news is and what isn't, what's fake and what's real for the most part, or how to sniff out BS. It just really, really bothers me. And I felt like the implications with this election are so huge. There's just been so much misinformation, disinformation, constant lies, especially about this pandemic since last March and before, that You know, if you're someone who's not savvy to the media or journalism, then it's pretty hard to figure out what's real and what's not. So I wanted to do something for Election Day, knowing that I had an episode coming out the day of, and decided that I wanted to talk to someone about media literacy. So that's what I did. So the guest for this episode is a woman named Julie Smith. She is a professor of media communications and digital literacy at Webster University in St. Louis. She is the author of Master the Media, How Teaching Media Can Save Our Plugged-In World. So in this episode, we kind of take a deep dive into all this stuff. And I wanted to hear what she had to say about, you know, what are some simple things that we can do to ensure that we're being well-informed, to know whether something's true or not in terms of a media piece, a news piece. So Julie was a lot of fun. You can tell this is something she really loves, and I just really appreciate her taking the time to do this. And so, you know, hopefully by the time this day is over, we'll know who the next president of the United States is going to be, one way or another. Whether we know by the end of today or tonight or not, I hope that whoever is the president isn't the president because he cheated. And, you know, what's really been difficult for me to watch is all the voter suppression that has been taking place. It's been pretty remarkable, and it seems pretty clear to me that there's one side who wants us to vote and one side who doesn't. So I just hope that going forward, we can do better than that. And I really, truly, in my heart of hearts, whether you lean right, lean left, liberal, conservative, whatever, what has always troubled me more than anything else about politics in our society is that everybody should be voting. 43 million people did not vote. Registered voters did not vote in the 2016 presidential election. So the good news is 2020, it looks like that's definitely not going to happen again. More than that, many people have voted early. So it's been a difficult time. It's been a turbulent time. It's been a tough 4 years, definitely a tough 2020. But I do have hope, and I feel like things are going to get better. It's all I can do is have that hope. So I hope you enjoy this. I feel like this was something good to do, a little bit of a public service to have Julie come on and talk about her work and her passion, and I hope you enjoy it. Julie Smith.
Just the product of bad seeds.
You know, I got to meet you through your friend, Alicia.
Alicia, yes. She's amazing.
You know, I'm going to get her on this show at some point, too. And if you've listened to the show, you might have heard the ad spot I did for Alicia's nonprofit, which is called the I Speak Media Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it's all about media literacy.
Yes, my favorite topic in the world.
So being that it's your favorite topic in the world, this is the Election Day episode of The Path to Authenticity.
Which is perfect timing.
Yeah, well, I think so. And, you know, this is something that I've talked about a little bit on the podcast. I actually had my high school journalism teacher on a while back, and we began to talk about this expression, this fake news expression that is thrown around so much in our society now, and the way in which journalists have even been labeled the enemy of the people, and, you know, all this craziness, which, you know, being someone who has a little bit of a journalism background, some experience, it really bothers me to hear that. And it scares me because our orientation as a culture, if we're not grounded in fact, then where are we? You know, what is our benchmark by which to judge anything we hear if we can't agree upon a certain set of facts? And I feel like that label fake news has been used as it's been weaponized, definitely. So,
well, I'd really like to retire that term, actually, because now it's kind of like the term cyberbullying, right? It gets people really worked up, but then it's overused to the point where it loses its punch. So misinformation and disinformation have been around forever, right? But now they travel at the speed of light. And the term fake news, and I'm using air quotes, Tom, the term really now is used by people who hear things that they just don't like. So what we're faced with, and what I think you were alluding to, is that we're living in what many consider a post-truth world, where the truth is subjective now, because we can pretty much find anything online that'll back up any crazy idea that we have, right? And so we're all dealing from different sets of facts. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I tend to think that it goes back to our news environment. The algorithms in the social media platforms that we use continually separate us every day. So there's a lot going on, and I think that media literacy can help this and at least maybe lessen the effects a little bit.
Well, so being that it's election day, I just thought it would be a great time to talk about this. And so one thing I was hoping maybe I could pose to you is, say, either you're a person who comes to this media environment in the United States, having had no experience with it at all, you know nothing about journalism, or maybe you're just an American who is, you know, they want to be well informed, but they don't really know how the news works and where to go and what to believe and what not to believe. What's the little shortcut, little mini guide that you would give those folks?
Well, the bad news is that it's not a mini guide. It's probably a maxi guide is what I would call it. The first thing to realize, if you know nothing about our media environment and our news environment, is that it is commercially based and commercially run and commercially supported. So the number one goal for anyone who's sharing information with us is not entertainment or information or education, although those things do happen, right? Mm-hmm. Their goal is to make money for the stockholders. So how do they do that? Well, they want to give us the news that they know we like because they have data about all of us viewers. They want to give us information and headlines and articles on their website that will keep us from clicking to a different website. And we have to be aware of the economic structure that, or the role that we play in the economic structure of all of this. So if we are using an app or a website for free, if we are consuming news for free, we are not the customer. We're the product being sold to the advertisers, because media is produced not to deliver content to an audience, but to deliver the audience to particular advertisers. So once you understand that the news is in existence to make money, that takes it to a different level, right? But also, we are losing our communal definition of what news is, because most Americans now are getting news from social media platforms. Well, how reliable are those? They're just platforms, right? They're not legally liable for what is posted on them. So you've got people with real journalism degrees, journalism experience, and journalism training on these platforms. But you also have, you know, your Aunt Bertha, who is sharing anything that she sees that she might agree with or that's fascinating. Because something to always remember is that if it's outrageous, it's contagious. And these websites, right, make more money if they keep us on the site longer. So there's really nothing in it for them to curb this, because while we are wound up about an election, we are more likely to believe bad things about the candidate we don't like. and more likely to believe good things about the candidate we do like. And we are less likely to check any of those for authenticity if it backs up and confirms what we already think, feel, believe. So this is how false information can spread so easily, especially because this is all happening, Tom, when the trust in the original mainstream media is at an all-time low. So there's a vacuum, right? We as Americans don't trust the traditional legacy media anymore as much as we used to. So there's a vacuum where other information can come in. And now it's so easy for anybody to create news or items online that look like legitimate news pieces. So it's kind of a perfect storm happening where all of this is happening at once. And we get emotionally involved. And when we're emotionally involved, we don't think rationally, right? So we're more likely to share something without checking it. And there's so many tools we can use to verify and check all of this online information. But it takes time. And a lot of people don't have time. And plus, if we really like the message, we don't want to debunk that message. So we're more likely just to share it on. So if someone is coming to this environment completely fresh, I would say have an internal BS detector activated at all times, act like a detective, and always be skeptical. Not cynical, but skeptical. You want to ask questions. Who's the sender of the message? What's their motive or intent? How did they create the message to get my attention? What information is left out? Who is profiting from this message? Am I getting the whole story? These are questions you want to ask about everything. And that's what media literacy skills are, is that constant critical thinking. We don't hate the media. It's a part of our lives. It's 11 hours a day part of our lives, right? So we don't hate it, but we're merely saying, look, if we're spending this much time with something, we should be talking about it more than we do. We should be analyzing more. And none of us really know political candidates in person. So we depend on the media to tell us about them. And they have an enormous responsibility, but their primary responsibility is to the stockholders. See, I told you it wasn't a little mini thing.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Well, just to kind of bring this to my little reality. So I subscribe to the New York Times. To me, you know, I'm trying to stay away from cable news because it's so upsetting to me. And, you know, I really, I caught onto this during a hurricane because I'm in South Florida. So there was a couple years ago, there was a Category 5 barreling down towards West Palm Beach where I live. And I was watching the Weather Channel and CNN. And I was kind of in a state of panic. And then at some point I thought, well, let me turn on the local news. And I remembered, you know, that local news affiliate, they're like giving practical information. It's more soothing. It's like, it's real practical information that I can use right now. Where the other, you know, CNN, the Weather, I was panicked. And I decided I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm done with that, you know?
There's research that shows the more cable news that someone consumes, the more they suffer from anxiety and depression. And we have to remember that the number one thing that sells is fear. And if we are scared of something, we are more likely to tune in and find out what's happening, right? We're breaking news. That's what we do, right? And that's why I always kind of tease our local stations. Fear sells so well. That's why I'm in Missouri, so we have blizzards, right? Every storm is the storm of the century, or Snowmageddon, right?
Snowmageddon.
And it's that same thing, because the ratings go up when big news happens. So it doesn't behoove any of those networks to downplay any story, because if they come on and say that everything's fine, you turn it off, right? So it's a relationship that we have with all this information, and we need it to be more active rather than passive. We need to be active consumers rather than just passive consumers constantly. Yeah.
Well, and I feel like I have the built-in BS detector. I mean, I pretty much am skeptical of any news, even if it's something I tend to agree with, if it leans the direction where I tend to lean.
Right.
You know, I still ask, I can tell, you know, well, that was true, but that was pretty snotty the way he said it. You know, that kind of,
yeah,
you know, I try to be objective in that way. But it's, can we talk a little bit about how we got here? Because
sure.
I think, and I'm, you know, I think I'm more well versed in these matters than most Americans. I could be wrong. Because I've paid attention for most of my life.
Right.
But, you know, I definitely don't have the expertise that you do. But can we talk about the media deregulation that took place in the 80s and 90s and how it relates to what's happening to me in right. media now?
Well, and we can kind of trace it right back to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which was signed by then President Clinton, which took away the restrictions of media outlets that organizations and corporations could own. So beforehand, we had many companies owning a few stations. Now we have a few companies owning all the stations.
Right.
So that's what enables an organization like iHeartMedia, which used to be iHeartRadio, to own, what, 2,000, 3,000 radio stations in the United States. And all of the playlists and the formats are identical, right? So it also took away the fairness doctrine.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was that law, so I'm sure someone can correct me. But the fairness doctrine was in effect until, it was a different law, actually, because the fairness doctrine was in effect until 1986. Mm-hmm. And what that stipulated is that in order to have your operating license, you needed to show both sides to any issue. So after that was phased out, then that's, for example, when Rush Limbaugh started his radio show.
Right.
Because he could come out and say, I'm a conservative, and he didn't have to provide time for the other side. So that kind of opened the door, shall we say, for the 24-hour news stations. People typically complain about Fox. And I always say, if you're going to complain about Fox, you got to complain about MSNBC, right? Mm-hmm. Because, and I always find it interesting, Tom, when people complain to me about bias, they'll say, well, the news is biased. And my response is, why do we feel we're entitled to objectivity? If objective news made money, we would have it, right? Mm. So the way I try to explain it to my students is, say that you run a TV station and you have data that 90% of your viewers are dog people. You are going to run great stories about dogs, and you are going to run stories that are anti-cat, right? Because your job is not to teach the dog people about the cats.
Right.
Your job is to keep the dog people from changing the channel. So essentially, we have Fox selling dog stuff and MSNBC selling cat stuff, right? Because it's a business decision. These are smart business people. These aren't journalists necessarily. They're smart business people who are giving their viewers what they want so the viewers don't change the channel and the ratings get higher and they can charge more for their advertising space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I would never complain about bias because I understand it is a business decision. So knowing that, then everyone should try to balance their media diet so that they get information from as many different sources as possible. And that sometimes gets to be challenging, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just easier for a lot of people to leave the same station on all the time, especially
sure.
if it reinforces your beliefs.
Absolutely. I mean, who wants to be confronted with messages that make us uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's called cognitive dissonance. It's this
right.
mental discomfort when we are faced with something that we don't like. And I'm a conflict avoider in general, so I really don't like it, right? But I read National Review, which is a conservative magazine. I read The Atlantic, which is a liberal magazine. I don't necessarily agree with everything in either magazine, but I feel like it's important for me to at least try to understand both sides, mm-hmm. which is harder and harder to do in today's media environment. And we're so polarized too, especially on social media platforms.
Yeah. Social media has really thrown a wrench in all this stuff, hasn't it?
It has, because it's made everybody feel like they're an expert and that their opinion matters.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's, and another thing I tell my students in their timelines, either on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok or Twitter, of course, none of them are on Facebook because they're under 30, but if they are consuming information from people who look just like them and act just like them and vote just like them, then they're missing out because we've never had more information at our fingertips ever, but we're, even though we're in a very high choice media environment, we're still very picky about what we consume. And I find that so interesting that we have all this information, but we still really only stick to one or two sources. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah. So going back to the Fox and MSNBC thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there was a time when I could have sort of observed that the folks at MSNBC made a decision to be more aggressively liberal in response to what Fox was doing, where before that, like Joe Scarborough, for example, was a Republican congressman from the Panhandle of Florida. He's not some bleeding heart liberal. That's not what he is. So, you know, that's, I feel like they tried to be relatively fair, and just that maybe it's that they started to see dollar signs being more liberal and they just gave up. I don't know, but I do believe I've gotten to where I watch almost only CNN, because I do feel like of those three, it is the most objective, most consistently. Would you agree with that?
There's many studies that point CNN as leaning left, but the charts about news bias that I like the best, Tom, are the ones that separate the commentators and the talking heads from the actual reporters.
Yeah.
So the news, I think, CNN is objective, but their talking heads and commentators are typically leaning left. Just like in the Wall Street Journal, the news section is objective, but their editorial page leans to the right. Mm-hmm. So what I think is a struggle for many people is they don't know, they cannot distinguish the difference between what is commentary and what is actual news. And that gets to be a challenge. You know, I had this weird idea that I wonder if we would be better informed if we had only 10 minutes of news a day as opposed to 24 hours.
Well, that's kind of, it used to be a half an hour, right? I mean, a half an hour of news every day.
And actually in the 60s, they would have 5-minute breaks throughout the day with headlines.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that in the news and television news, at least, they didn't sell commercials because they considered it to be a public service, which I find fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and I just wonder how we get back there. And then, you know, there's so many facets of this. You know, you mentioned commentators versus reporters, and you know, I had a conversation with Alicia about, you know, probably Rachel Maddow is labeled as the most liberal of any of these folks, but I also feel like she really does stories. I mean, she goes deep into stories. And I never feel like I'm being lied to by her, ever. But what Alicia pointed out is she isn't really a journalist.
No.
And a lot of these folks are not journalists. And I think that's a big part of the problem because they don't have the ethical groundedness that journalists are taught, right?
Right. They're storytellers. Or they look really good on camera and they're very natural at reading a teleprompter, right? Whereas a journalist has training on how to investigate stories, how to verify stories, how to make sure that they can find accurate sources and try to be objective. You know, the Society of Professional Journalists has a pretty long list of ethical requirements. You know, but I tend to think that our media environment does not celebrate true journalism, because journalism, you know, usually provides, and I'm using journalism with a capital J, provides context, right?
Right.
And in our world, we like to consume information as quickly as possible. And we don't have time to know what's going on in Syria. We can look at some pictures of some injured kids and say, oh yeah, something's going on. But we don't make the time or take the time to figure out what's actually going on over there. And I'm not sure anybody's even telling us anyway, because there's no money in it.
Right.
It can be discouraging at times, but I think with the media literacy movement catching some momentum, and I think people are recognizing how all of this is making them feel, yeah. Right? There's this information glut where we're trying to get information out of a fire hose, essentially. I think that people are starting to realize that, hey, maybe we should be analyzing this a little more, talking about it a little more, because these are skills that people need to figure out what is real, what is meaningful, what is valid, what is true. Mm. And it requires work. Like, I don't trust Mark Zuckerberg to do that for me. Right.
No,
I don't trust Jack Dorsey to do that for me.
Yeah.
I don't trust the government to do it for me. So it's up to us. The responsibility is ours. I think I might have been Tom Brokaw who said people get the news they deserve.
Mm.
Which is an interesting way to look at it, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah. I might be misquoting him, but I know it was something along those lines.
So here's something that I've wondered over the last 4 years, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, how the Washington Post has like chronicled all the lies that have come out of the White House. And at this point,
right,
we must be near 40,000 or something crazy like that. At what point does it become irresponsible for a journalist to continue to go back to a source who's not credible, even if it's the president of the United States?
I think that that's a decision the journalist and their editor has to make, because at some point you still need that source, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to, I don't think you want to burn any bridges. But what the Post is doing is reporting, but also correcting.
Right.
So I think they're covering their bases. And another issue too, Tom, I think something came out yesterday that such a large percentage of journalists who are covering the election have given thousands of dollars to Biden's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are wondering how objective they can really be covering the campaign anyway. And you know what too, this is, and I just learned this last week, I had a student say, okay, I see people posting things that I know are false online. How do I call them? Do I call them out? And I always say, yes, please. It's our job to help police this, but you want to do it gently. You want to do it privately, right? You don't want to call anybody out and publicly shame them. But in most cases, there's something called the familiarity backfire effect. In most cases, when you tell someone that what they've shared is incorrect and you share with them actual data to prove it, right? In most cases, they will dig in.
Right.
Very rarely does someone say, oh, you know what? You're right. I never thought of it that way. Many cases, they will say, well, yeah, but I still believe it. So we're in a really strange position where I feel like it's our responsibility to help people figure out what's real and what's not. But at the same time, in many cases, it doesn't even work.
Well, and help. I think we're seeing that to its fullest expression with this administration. Because, I mean, look at all the people who went to jail.
Well,
from his campaign,
in D.C. going to jail is not a news. Is not
well, okay,
new.
but I mean, so many things have, you know, we know the Russians interfered with the election. Whether they can prove that Trump himself had anything to do with any sort of, we know that there was impropriety going on, And key people in his campaign got, you know, in trouble for it. And then he pardoned them. And that there's that's an example of you say that to a smart person who's on Trump's side or is a supporter. I mean, they just don't believe it.
Well, because there's stories that contain nuggets of truth from both sides of that. Mm-hmm. And so you can cling to that, right? And say, what was it someone said the other day? Someone from the CDC like had said, oh, they said that masks aren't needed. The CDC said that masks weren't helpful. Right. And immediately someone said, oh, well, that's somebody that Trump installed. Like we have this automatic suspicion, which mm-hmm. I think is dangerous for whoever ends up in the Oval Office the next 4 years. There's no trust. There's no trust in any of our institutions. Mm-hmm. And that can be disheartening.
Yeah. I feel like we have a lot of work to do when
yeah,
it comes
we do.
To,
we do. I think something really important to do is to teach people about clickbait headlines, because there were teenagers in Macedonia making $60,000 a month in 2016, creating websites that had clickbait headlines. And because people were clicking on them, these kids were making a ton of money through Google AdSense. Oh my and gosh. We can't legislate that. It originates in other countries, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who's at fault for us believing misinformation online? I don't blame the Russians.
Yeah.
It was actually very smart. I blame us. It's our responsibility.
Yeah.
To figure out what's real and what's not. And it's not that hard to do. There's so many great tools online that you can use to verify a Twitter account, to search to see if a photo is being recycled or reused or reframed from a different location or event. You can find out the ratio of Twitter followers to who they follow. You can find out where and when a particular YouTube video was uploaded. And there's all of these tools that are at people's disposal, but we just don't choose to use them.
Hmm. So how did you get here to doing this kind of work? You know, because that's usually what I talk to folks about, you know?
How did I get here? Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because my undergraduate degree is public relations, and I ended up working for a company that paid for graduate school. And I thought, well, if somebody's going to pay for my graduate school, I might as well get a master's, right? And what did I really like in school? If I'm going to work all day and sit in class all night, it has to be something interesting. So I'm going to get a master's in mass communication. So I loved it. I loved it so much. But what was interesting, Tom, is that studying mass comm in the late 1990s was television, radio, movies, and newspapers.
Right.
Right. So when I started teaching, it was teaching students how to read advertisements and all about how to watch television critically. Then here we go into the internet and platforms and the democratization of content production. Like we can create things ourselves now. It's because we used to be 100% media consumers. Well, now we are producers also, right? Because all of the really big websites, it's user-generated content. So I ended up teaching adjunct at two universities, Webster University in St. Louis and Southern Illinois University. And then I ended up with a full-time position at Webster University. So now I'm the major facilitator of the media studies degree. And I absolutely love, love, love my job. But here's what's weird is that because this is my weird little niche, right, of media literacy and information literacy, I get asked to do a lot of presentations and conference keynotes and things like that. And it is so fun because when I tell people I teach media literacy, they look at me kind of weird, like they don't understand. But then when I explain what it is, their reaction is, oh, yeah, we need that. That's cool.
Yeah.
So I almost feel like we need a different name for what we're trying to accomplish. But now I teach intro to mass media. I teach media literacy. I teach digital media and culture to undergraduates. And I really do have the greatest job in the whole wide world because I get to talk about what I love and share what I love with people that are really fun and engaging. So I feel very, very lucky to have the job I do.
Well, you know, having been a student and listening to you, I know that they're also very lucky to have you because all the best teachers are the teachers who love what they're teaching.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Yeah.
I remember I had this Mrs. Bollinger, this teacher, Lynn Bollinger, for American Lit as a junior in high school. And I mean, she brought Hester Prynne to life.
Aww.
You know, I mean, she just was so passionate about it. You know, Huck Finn and the Scarlet Letter. I mean, and Poe and Whitman, and it just, it was just, it taught me that lesson that when, I mean, she taught comp classes most of the time, and I had had her, actually, I had her for a media class at one point, but she was completely different in that lit class. And so this is your version of that, right?
And you know what? You remember her because she was so excited, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's teaching is such an interesting gig, and especially in higher ed, most, I would say all of us, unless you teach in the education department, have never actually had a class on how to teach. We're content experts, right? But that doesn't mean that we're necessarily good at delivering the information. And K-12 teachers who teach all day long, 5 days a week, they have very extensive training and certification that ironically teachers in higher ed do not have or need. It's so strange when you really think about it. Wow. Yeah. So a typical day for me would be, I'm a morning person. I'm usually in the office by 7 or 7:30, and I am prepping. I'm thinking about what am I doing in my next class? In the next time I see them, what are we going to do in class? And what am I going to do to make it as engaging as possible? Because I do not lecture. I hate it. All my lectures are on YouTube so the students can watch them as homework. But when we're in class, I want it to be discussion-based. I want there to be some activity that gets them either out of their seat or into whatever the topic is of the day. So I spend a lot of time trying to plan my classes to make them as engaging as possible. I also spend a lot of time with my advisees. So I had several meetings even yesterday with students who are trying to figure out what they should enroll in for next semester because registration starts pretty soon. We spend a lot of time in meetings. Ironically, none of the meetings are about teaching. A lot of meetings about planning and assessment and that sort of thing. So I could do without the meetings because I don't think that many of the meetings in higher ed are really that productive. I wish it was just classes all day long because it's my favorite. My favorite. So I usually get home about 3 or 4 and then I just think about work the rest of the night. I never turn it off, which I'm sure doesn't make me much fun to live with, but it just means that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so. So
I hope so. Anyway,
you studied PR in your undergraduate work. So what drew you to that? And a lot, I don't know, probably most people don't know, but PR is kind of the flip side of journalism. Usually the schools they're part of the same school at universities very often.
Right. Right. Well, journalists try to tell the truth. PR practitioners try to tell whatever story will make their client look good.
Right.
And it can be a lot of things. It can be event planning. It can be merchandising. Of course, it can be attempts to get good publicity. I always think that one of the differences between journalism and PR is that a journalist has one audience, right? But a PR person has to deal with the government, has to deal with the media, has to deal with employees, has to deal with potential stockholders. There's a lot that a PR person has to take into account. But that background, I think, is helpful when you might be trying to sell a student the idea on how important media literacy is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think of it as just kind of it's a sales gig.
Yeah.
And you're selling ideas and concepts, not necessarily products.
Well, and there was a time when the people who worked in PR were the journalists who got tired of not making any money. Right.
Right. Yeah, that could be.
And then
true
they
too.
Turned to the dark side. That's kind of how other journalists looked at it, right? That
yeah.
They went to the dark side.
That I think that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and you know, my experience of working in the addiction treatment industry, you know, having I was a stringer at a newspaper where I grew up covering high school sports, and you know, I had this great high school journalism program that I went through. And then I get into the addiction treatment industry and I train as a counselor. And lo and behold, there's a position in the marketing department that involved writing press releases and ads and all this stuff. And, you know, I had the skills for it. So yeah. So I transitioned into PR and it really, it was a great education for me to learn, because it's you got to be out there and part of everything in the community and really connected if you're a community-based organization and you're working
and
in PR.
And really, I mean, if you think about it, most jobs do have a PR component. Mm-hmm. If you're waiting on tables, you're in PR for yourself. Right. If you're the dean, you are in PR for the entire school or the university. Mm-hmm. If you're in sales, you're in PR not just for you, but for your brand. Right. It's about brand management, brand recognition, and brand loyalty. And I think that involves what most of us do every day in one way or another.
Yeah. That's well put, because we don't always think about that. But, you know, that's one of the messages that I used to try to get across to the other departments. Like, it's not just me, it's all of us.
It's everybody. Right. Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is a blessing and a curse sometimes. Right.
Yes. Yes. So how did you end up studying PR? What, you know, when you're younger,
You know what? I'm really not sure what drew me to public relations. I knew that I needed to be a communication major because I love to communicate, and organizational communication didn't sound nearly as exciting to me as public relations did. I changed my major a few times actually before I really found where I was supposed to be. And that's something that a lot of my students and my advisees struggle with, that they feel like they need to have their career all ironed out by graduation, or that they need to have their major decided when they enter college. And I always say, oh my gosh, no, like, be open to all possibilities. Take as many different classes as you can at the beginning and see what strikes you. You know, let your major find you. And I really didn't, I never grew up thinking I want to be a university instructor. I grew up knowing that I wanted to be a mom for sure, but the university job kind of found me. And then I realized that that's exactly what I was supposed to be doing. So I got lucky with my undergrad, but I got really, really lucky with my master's. Mm. I wish I had a better way to explain it, that I had some, you know, road to Damascus moment about public relations, but I really didn't. It might have just been that, you know, it could have been, Tom, that it was the major that I could graduate early with.
Right. Well, you know, no, but this is great, because, you know, one of the things, this podcast is about, you know, us being who we are.
Right.
And that's what you're talking about, rather than coming up with some preordained idea of who I should be later, you know. Feel it out. See where it goes.
Yeah. And I was open to what the world was going to show me. And it was probably, 27 or so before I realized I was doing what I was meant to do.
Well, and I think I see parents put a lot of pressure on kids to know what they want
at 18. So
and it's just so unrealistic.
It really is.
You know, I really, for a time, thought there was something wrong with me because I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And I wasn't sure about it all the time. And I wasn't someone who, like, knew when I was 15 that I wanted to grow up and do whatever. But, you know, that's most of us. And most of us change careers at some point.
And it could be, too, that the job that our kids end up having doesn't even exist yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think of the jobs that all the social media management jobs that exist now that didn't exist 20 years ago. We have no idea. That's why I don't think you ever want to paint yourself into a corner and say, I'm going to do X, because X might not be perfect for you and you might end up liking Y better. You just never know.
And the mystery is what makes life exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's, I've been very, very lucky. That's for sure.
So what's been the most challenging part of all this for you?
That's a really good question. I think this is going to sound weird, but my very first response when you ask me that is keeping students interested and making students care about all this. That is always a challenge because they are young. They don't care about the quote unquote news very much yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been a challenge to get them interested. It's also something that I have dealt with, and this is my own personal baggage. I do not have a PhD. And so I have been constantly in the back of my mind, always dealing with this inferiority complex on campus because I don't have one. But I know I'm an excellent teacher, right? I just don't have that research background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a challenge for me because I'm not used to feeling inferior very often, but that is something that I'm trying to work on, is recognize my value, even though I don't have those letters after my name.
Well, I didn't finish college, you know, and in the midst of my college experience, I crashed and burned from an alcoholism standpoint and stopped drinking when I was 23 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
Which ended up being such a gift. You know, talk about how we never know what to expect. I mean, before I got involved in writing and journalism, I wanted to be on the radio. And we had a high school radio station, and I was on it one year. And, you know, I was approached by somebody trying to recruit me for the newspaper staff. And I was like, no, I'm going to be on the radio. Well, then the tower got struck by lightning that spring.
Oh my gosh. The next year
rolls around. They didn't have the money to replace it. And so that's how I ended up on the newspaper staff.
Wow. So all because of a lightning strike.
Right. And how that writing worked into my substance abuse treatment career I've used it in every job I've had. And then now doing this podcast, I mean, really the path to authenticity, why I arrived at that is because I wanted to use everything I've learned in my experience working with addiction and somehow universalize it. And addiction is a betrayal of oneself. That's what it is.
Mm.
So it's just an example of how we just never know. But I feel the same way often that, you know, and honestly, I kept going to school well into my career, and I ended up stopping when I married someone who had young kids and I became a dad, you know?
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, it just never has been a time when it seemed like it made sense to go back to school. And I've also gotten far enough along. I haven't needed it. You know, the other part of it is most people are really surprised when I tell them that I don't have a degree. I mean, they can't tell, you know?
Right.
I've gone out of my way to educate myself in a lot of ways. And I also I have a little bit of an issue with the way education is structured in our society because it doesn't exactly invite curiosity. I mean, you think about college, there are all these classes you have to take that you're not the least bit interested in. And what if it was What if it was more like a Montessori sort of thing where you steered kids towards what they actually wanted to do?
Right. There's a movement in the K-12 schools called Genius Hour or Passion Projects, where they kind of let students loose to research and work on something that really, really turns them on, right? Yeah. And they're finding that if a student chooses the topic, that they're so much more engaged and that they can learn something much in a much deeper way. And I believe that because, you know, I was at some conference and someone said, would you be willing to go to a hospital that was modeled after a hospital 100 years ago? And the answer is obviously no, right? And yet every school classroom is still modeled the same as a classroom was 100 years ago.
Yes.
And we don't, my students don't learn that way. You know, I have colleagues who stand and lecture for 90 minutes at a time and I just don't know how a 19-year-old in today's world can really absorb any of that information.
Yeah.
But I'm judgy that way. I mean, I try not to lecture and I try to make my classes as active as possible. And you know, maybe sometime a sit and get environment really works, but it doesn't always, I don't feel like it works for me. I get bored too easily.
Yeah. I think it probably works well after the students are engaged.
They're already interested
in the topic and then you go deeper into it. That's
right.
A little different.
Yeah, that's probably very true. But again, that's another indication of how the K-12 teachers have more training than we do.
Right. Well, and so, you know, the end of my college career, I mean, I made a conscious decision, you know, I'm not taking that class. I'm taking the astronomy class because even though I don't need it, I want to learn about astronomy, you know,
right.
And I made a series of decisions like that where, you know, I'm just not going to do it. If I'm going to especially because I was working and I had a good job where they're doing the tuition reimbursement thing. And if I'm going to work all day and then go to school and then do all the homework, it's going to be something I want to learn about.
Absolutely. And when that desire is there, you're more likely to learn and remember. Mm. Because curiosity, you know, I think students are so used to just sitting and getting, you know, like just sit there and tell me things that they're not used to actually having the choice of what they want to learn about. Mm. And that's tough.
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't get quite as personal with you as I generally get with my guests. So I hope this question doesn't come out of left field too much for you. But so given your history and everything you've been through in life, your educational career, if you had to go back at some point and speak to the younger Julie when she needed some advice or encouragement, when might that have been and what would you say to her?
Julie was, 22-year-old Julie was unemployed and selling plasma for cash. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
I would go back and tell her, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, you're a smart kid. You'll figure something out. Have faith that things usually always work out, maybe not on your schedule or the way you expected. But I would encourage her to, I have a dear friend who says this frequently, pull back to 35,000 feet and look at where you are. You know, you have your degree, you're a smart kid, you're ambitious, you'll be okay. But in the day-to-day, you know, trying to make ends meet, it's hard to see the big picture. But I would go back and I would encourage her to look at the big picture and think, you know, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay.
Yeah. You know, one of the lessons that I've learned in life is as parents, as mentors, teachers, whatever, one of the best things that we can do for someone is believe in them.
Yep.
Because Julie didn't, you know, you didn't believe in yourself.
Well,
yet.
No.
You didn't have the evidence yet. But, you know. We are resilient animals. We're capable. And, that's something that having a 14-year-old boy, I mean, I always want my son to know that I believe in him.
Yeah. That will serve him so well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do, it's not like I'm just saying that. I mean, I do.
Right.
But, that's also, there was a point in my life when I had this sort of mentor. He was a therapist who, I was working with one of his clients, and, he was kind of a few notches up the ladder from me, but we were collaborating on this case, and I was reporting to him the behavior that I was seeing in this client. And I would go to him and say, well, he didn't make his bed, or he didn't do this, or he didn't do that. And John would say, yeah, but he's really great at this. And it would just baffle me. And after that happened several times, it hit me that, he sees the good.
Of course he does.
He sees the good, and I'm not seeing the good. And I want to be someone who sees the good. Yeah, it is. But we also have to train our eyes sometimes, because there is good in all of us. And it's easier to point out the bad in a profession like mine, because it's glaring. But sometimes it takes a little more. It takes time and patience and effort and a good ear, listening to hear what someone is good at and affirm them for that. And it just became the kind of thing where that's the type of person I want to be. I don't want to be the person who doesn't see the good. I don't want to be the person who doesn't believe in someone.
Right.
And I like that about myself,
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful quality. And it's contagious. There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about how hope is actually a contagious emotion, and that we should cultivate it more than we do, especially now with the pandemic and the whole, political dramas going on, that hope is a good thing. And it's something that we can share with other people. Other people pick it up from us.
Yeah. Well, and it's something that I've had a pretty hard time with over the course of the last year, especially. And I'm generally a pretty hopeful person, but one of the things, what has gotten me so upset about what's happening politically in the United States right now is that I've also studied the Constitution a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I know enough about the government to know what the do's and don'ts are of the presidency and how he's supposed to function with the other branches of government and what's not happening and how much he's challenging the norms. And what I hope is that that's going to end up being a really good thing, because as a nation, we make the adjustments constitutionally or legislatively that we need to make sure that, another president doesn't come in with a wrecking ball. And, just things like defying the congressional subpoenas. I mean, I don't think the framers of the Constitution ever expected a president to do that and get away with it. But anyway, yeah. So, back in the spring when there were all these virtual commencement addresses, and President Obama did one. And one of the things he said was that, our country's been through a lot. I mean, been through other tough times. And I forget that. And you look at the video of what happened before the Civil Rights Act, went through, and the things that happened in the South. Man, it was scary looking stuff that was going on.
Can you imagine what Facebook and Twitter and Instagram would have been like then?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or the Vietnam War with the things that were showing up on television, the nightly news during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I could just talk to you forever. This has been great.
Well, I'm so happy that you asked me to join you. It's such interesting questions and questions I really hadn't thought about before. So it's been really interesting for me too.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Julie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.